You're listening to the Fourth Wall Comics Podcast, episode 24, recorded September 16th, 2012.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Wall Comics Podcast, episode 24. I am Freddie.
And I'm Danny.
And we are here once again to talk about some more issues of Before Watchmen, the controversial comic book series that just keeps going. And they keep adding titles to it, because apparently out of the seven here, that's not all. There's just announced another one, Before Watchmen Moloch, that's going to be also written by J. Michael Straczynski. So maybe we'll be back to talk some more about these series. We'll have to wait until then and see.
DC likes their events to last as many years as possible, so who knows how long
they'll keep pulling out like secondary characters. Like maybe there's like, remember that scene in Minutemen where they have like all the D-rank people that didn't even get onto the team, like the slut and the guy named
the
Hank.
The Frogman.
Yeah.
Hank.
They'll have like Before Watchmen Hank. Written by whoever they can find. Just keep it going. We need that money. Anyway. So the seven books that are out as of the time of this recording are Minutemen, Silk Spectre, The Comedian, Night Owl, Ozymandias, Rorschach, and Dr. Manhattan. So previously, in July, in podcast number 20, we talked about Minutemen, Silk Spectre, and The Comedian, the first issues of all those. And we seem to pretty much enjoy Minutemen and Silk Spectre. With Comedian, we were kind of not sure about that one, not sure where it was going to go. And I guess we can start out with that one, because it has definitely not gotten better as the series has gone on.
No.
I think in both of our opinions, it's probably one of the weakest of the whole, all seven of them right now. Danny, why do you think that's the one that people should definitely avoid?
Well, I said it in the last podcast, and then the last, when we only did the first issue, and these second and third issues kind of confirm it for me, this is the least necessary story out of all of these. Now that we've had at least one issue of every series, this is the least necessary story, because the original Watchmen, I think, was mostly the comedian story. Like, everyone has a part. It's a big ensemble story, but out of all of the characters, even though he's dead for most of the story, and everything he has is flashbacks in the original Watchmen, it's like it seems like it's mostly his story. And so we learned a lot about him from Alan Moore's original. And I don't know if are we saying the name Alan Moore? Are we putting that?
Yes, we're going to allow it in this time.
Okay. So Alan Moore's original writing, we learned almost everything there was to know about the Comedian, everything that was relevant. And now we're being told more, and it's completely unnecessary. And probably the biggest problem is Brian Azzarello's take on the character does not mesh with the character that we know from the original comic, or even if you've seen the movie. And I know there's been controversy because Dave Gibbons said that Before Watchmen is not canonical, that it exists in its own canon.
Right.
So he said not to read Before Watchmen and think of it as being truly connected to the original Watchmen.
Right.
But even so, this is the least possibly connected, because Brian Azzarello's take on Comedian is subtly not the Comedian we read. I think everyone else's take meshes well, like everyone's take on Rorschach and Night Owl. They all seem like the original actual characters, but it kind of reminds me of the slight controversy around Brian Azzarello's Joker, how some people were upset with the scene where Joker is seen crying after he's with the prostitute, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And like some people were like, Joker shouldn't be seen being remorseful or crying. And I was like, I actually had no problem with that scene, because it's his take on the Joker. It is conceivably his own universe, I mean, of Batman. So he can do whatever he wants with the character. But this is supposed to be the Watchmen universe. It's supposed to be the original Comedian. And he's too empathetic.
Yeah,
and
he's trying to humanize him.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand humanizing Comedian a little bit, and he was human. There were moments of being humanized in Watchmen, in the original book, and I think that's all we needed, because that's what made his character great, the fact that he was a sociopath, but And, you know, he masqueraded as a hero, but was he a hero? That sort of ambiguity. And I don't think Brian Azzarello's take on the character and his trying to humanize him adds anything to the character. I think, if anything, it takes away from the mystique and the ambiguity of the original character. So that's really why I think it's the worst out of all the series.
Another reason that it kind of feels disjointed is every issue takes place a year after the last one. So with the first issue, we see the comedian find out that his friend, JFK, has been assassinated. And then in the second issue, he goes to Vietnam and he's dealing with all that. And then he comes back home and the people are protesting. And that's where he sees Sally Jupiter. She's one of the girls protesting, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if... That was kind of unclear for me. I think it's just someone that might have just looked like her.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was really unclear if that was actually her. And then some army people show up and break up the protest by throwing tomatoes at them.
Yeah, that was kind of weird because I thought she had got shot the way that they did that. And I was oh, they're just throwing tomatoes. Okay.
And that's what really made me think that it wasn't actually Silk Spectre, that it was actually, you know, that it was just someone that looked like her that was making him think of his daughter for a second, his secret daughter. But yeah, I was completely unclear on that. So that's another problem is
I think the reason I thought that, I mean, maybe it's not, but she's wearing the yellow kind of jumpsuit dress looking thing.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been, honestly, but it's just hard to tell because it was kind of ambiguous, even though I was saying ambiguity was a good thing for Alan Moore's take on his character, the comedian. In this case, it's more of a hindrance when Brian Azzarello is a little bit more unclear. Yeah, like that entire scene, him stopping to even talk.
Yeah,
to the
he
hippies,
wouldn't do that. Yeah.
No. Even if it actually was Silk Spectre, his secret daughter, I don't think he'd even stop for that because he still treated her, you know, as badly as he treated everybody else throughout the original Watchmen. So why would he be introspective about seeing someone that kind of looked like her?
Right.
There's all kinds of little moments where he's humanized. And, I mean, I'm not saying that that's a bad take on any character who's portrayed as a villain or portrayed as, like, an anti-hero. But it's just, it doesn't mesh. And like I said, Alan Moore did that. He had little moments where, you know, the comedian was having some sort of inner crisis, but he didn't go into it too much. And this is just the most unnecessary story. It really ruins the character. And like you said, the story is completely incohesive. Like, one issue does not follow the next one. And in a lot of ways, one part of the issue does not follow the next one. It's really just a bunch of vignettes of what Brian Azzarello thinks, you know, comedian might have been doing over the decades.
Right.
And I don't agree with it at all. So I would definitely not suggest this one to anybody.
So after this is issue 3 that we're talking about now, are you pretty much going to drop this one?
No.
No, you're going to stay with it?
Well, and then that's the other thing is some of these Before Watchmen miniseries are 4 issues. Some are 6.
Yeah, this one's 6.
I can't believe this one's 6 because it really doesn't – it feels like it could be done now. Like, I don't know what it's building towards. I don't know what ending is supposed to be. But I'm going to stick with it just because, you know, I want to have read all of Before Watchmen. So, yeah, like, if this was its own thing, then yes, I would drop it. But the fact that it's Before Watchmen and I'm sticking with the whole ordeal,
right,
then I am going to finish it just for the sake of being a completionist.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I can justify buying this. But
yeah,
there's so many of these, and there's going to be another one. I think I'm pretty much, this is the one I'm done with. But one that I'm not done with that's getting a lot of praise is Silk Spectre. There's only going to be 4 of these, and the most recent issue number 3, actually had a cameo appearance by the comedian toward the end of it, which was very effective. I thought he was better utilized in that
Definitely.
One scene than the entire 3 issues that Brian Azzarello wrote. One thing that I wasn't completely thrilled about, which you can tell by looking at the covers of Silk Spectre, is the very psychedelic tone that the book took, especially with issues 2 and 3. Her and her boyfriend move to San Francisco and get involved in this peace, love, hippie movement, and there's a kind of an anti-commercialism meaning with the backstory of this, where there's a guy who's selling, what is it, acid or some type of legal drug. I think it's acid, and all the kids are taking it, and it's forcing them to be more like consumers and buy things even though they can't afford them. And it's kind of heavy-handed, and that's why this one isn't like my favorite, like on the top of my list as far as all seven of these. It still is really good. I still Amanda Conner's art is phenomenal. I'm interested to see now that I think all the like hippie stuff is out of the way, because with the way that issue number three ends, it's kind of traumatic things happening to her as a character, Silk Spectre. So, you know, she's been basically ripped away from the guy that she loves. So it's going to be really interesting seeing how Amanda Conner and Darwin Cook end this. And, you know, it's going to be the first one to end. It'll probably be the first one out in trade. So, but, and, you know, with that, with my complaints aside, I think this is definitely an example of, as opposed to Comedian, this is something like, it's shedding a new light on the character. It's a different, it's not like, it doesn't read like Watchmen. You know, it's not trying to be dark. It has a lighter tone to it. It has silly moments, you know, like the moments we talked about within issue one, where she has the kind of like fantasy moments where it kind of goes cartoonish in certain points. So yeah, what did you think about issue three of Silk Spectre?
I definitely like this. We were discussing before we started the show, you know, what our top 10 list was, and I put this one at the top. This is my number one. Maybe it kind of will juggle back and forth with a few other ones. It could be two or three. I'm not sure, but I think this is definitely in my top three of this whole Before Watchmen thing. I agree with you that I like how it's sort of, this one sort of treads the line between the dark, brooding atmosphere of Watchmen and most of the other Before Watchmen stuff, and sort of a more bright, you know, fun sort of tone, which, you know, Watchmen isn't really known for. I remember issue two, though, when she was, you know, she's living in San Francisco, and she's going out during the night as Silk Spectre and beating up bad guys, and then she finds out about this plot for this guy to spread all these drugs and commercialism, and then she goes home to this, she goes, at the end of issue two, she goes home to her house, and there's a party going on, and everyone's doing this drug, and she doesn't realize it's the bad drug that she just learned about, and she takes it, and then she sees that bad guy walk in the door, and he's like hosting the party, and she's like, oh shit. And I remember there being like a very palpable sense of dread in me, because for issue two, where she's like, you know, spending all this time with her boyfriend and being really happy, and I was actually kind of like sold, like the way they're presenting Silk Spectre, like I really actually root for her, you know, in a way that, you know, I think most writers want you to root for their character. Right. I'm actually like hoping for the best for her, even though I know it couldn't possibly end well, because it's got to get to the point where Watchmen begins. I know she's not going to stay with this boyfriend, because there's no even mention of him in the original Watchmen.
Right.
So, but I remember like this very palpable sense of dread, like, oh boy, things are about to go bad. And then issue three starts and nothing really goes bad. Like, I guess the bad guy who was spreading this drug didn't realize it was Silk Spectre that he just drugged. It was just, you know, her secret identity. So she wakes up okay. So that issue didn't turn out the way I expected. I also, one nice touch was how those little panels where it's showing how she feels in like, and it shows an image that represents her mind, like the little fantasy moment. I don't know if you noticed it, but in this issue, like all her little fantasy moments are like
paintings,
takes on classical art. And then if you look in her bedroom in the background, there's all these art books everywhere. So she's been like studying art, and it's reflected in her fantasies now, as opposed to her early fantasies, which in the first issue, which were all like childish, you know, Disney cartoon looking stuff. Right. So I like that subtle, you know, it's always wonderful. It's also always nice to see those kind of subtle takes and actually be able to find, you know, notice them without them being shoved in your face. So I think there's a lot of care and consideration in the writing for this version of Silk Spectre, where there's definitely something added to the character that wasn't in Watchmen, and it feels like you wouldn't have known it was necessary, but now it feels like it actually adds something to the original story, as opposed to Comedian, which doesn't, which kind of takes away from the original story a little bit.
What did you think about the way that the Comedian shows up at the end of issue 3 of Silk Spectre and finds the smiley face button, and that's kind of, you know, the backstory of him using that? How did you feel about that?
I thought that was okay.
I was actually thinking, like, that didn't bother me, but for some reason, when it showed in the issue of Night Owl that the end is nigh sign and he goes to church and that's how he gets the sign, I just thought that was so dumb. And I can't say why I thought that was dumb and this one wasn't, because, I mean, maybe this one was a little bit more subtle. I guess that would be an explanation, you
right.
know?
It would make sense for there to be smiley faces around her apartment because she's a hippie and that was a thing at the time, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that kind of leads us in. We'll go ahead and talk about the other Brian Azzarello book. Rorschach. Is only one issue is out at the time of recording this, and I think I'm pretty much done with this one as well.
Well, this one I wouldn't be as bad on. I wouldn't be as critical as I was of Comedian.
Right.
Because this one...
Rorschach goes into the sewers looking for a guy who is dealing drugs, gets the crap beat out of him, and then there's a guy going around like carving up women. And
right. So yeah, I mean, this one just kind of plays like a B movie. And at least it's actually a story from beginning to end, unlike Comedian, which is like I said, seems like a series of vignettes from his life. This is again really. As far as a story about Rorschach, this doesn't seem like the most necessary. It just seems like here's a little side story. Here's an adventure he had one time, which doesn't seem necessary, but it's still, you know, it's not completely unwelcome to see just a, you know, a side case that he handled at one point. If that's where all of these issues for the Rorschach miniseries will go, I'm not opposed to that. It's still not very good, but it's definitely better than Comedian, in my opinion.
I think you definitely hit the nail on the head as far as the, like, B-movie grindhouse feel for it. It even has, like, a grindhouse movie theater showing, like, Let Them Die Slowly or one of those exploitation movies in the beginning of the establishing shot of gritty 70s New York City.
Right.
But it just didn't bring anything new or fresh to the table. And
right.
That's why I don't think I can – I'm going to be sticking with that one either.
And this one is by the art's by Lee
Bermejo.
Bermejo, yeah.
Yeah.
Who did what I mentioned before was Brian Azzarello's Joker graphic novel. So, I mean, those two, they've worked together before. And it's so they definitely know what the art in this is way better than Comedian. That's, I definitely think that. As far as, you know, is it a Watchmen style? That's debatable.
Mm hmm.
It's got that, you know, very glossy neon kind of look to it, which adds to that whole grindhouse feel that you were just mentioning.
Right. So, I mean, I kind of mentioned it earlier. I guess we can kind of segue into Night Owl from Rorschach because they end up teaming up in this. This one's written by J. Michael Straczynski, art by Andy Kubert. And this one kind of is just the one that falls in the middle for me. It has a lot of these have a lot of that weird sexual things going on in it with BDSM and bondage and all that weirdness, which I don't. I mean, I know that was a lot of that was hinted at in the original Watchmen, but it seems like it just keeps coming up in so many of these books, the dark side of sexuality and things like that. It's weird seeing Night Owl drawn to that dominatrix woman in issue 2.
If you remember that. You know, in Watchmen, he's, what's the word? Not infertile. What's it called when you can't get it up? You know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about, Freddy.
Yeah, I know. Thanks.
Thanks for telling everyone
about my problem. God.
Not sterile, but, you know.
Yeah, we gotcha.
Erectile dysfunction.
Yes.
He has erectile dysfunction in Watchmen, so maybe that this is some sort of explanation for how they came along, or maybe he's already dealing with it, and this is something he's hoping will... you know, help him with that problem, but they just haven't really said as much in these issues.
Right. It was cool seeing Night Owl, you know, worship the original Night Owl, Hollis Mason, and then him in issue 1 basically being like, okay, you're going to be the new Night Owl, and you know this. I'm basically training you to become this, and that whole process was really great to see. Issue two was almost more like, what's up with Rorschach? Like, why is Rorschach, you know, like, why is he so messed up?
Yeah. I like this. I agree that out of all of the series, this one kind of ends up in the middle. But I think that when I've mentioned which of these stories is necessary, this one again feels more necessary because it's actually, I mean, I don't know, how many issues is this one? Is this four or six?
Four.
Four? Okay, yeah. So that makes sense because I don't think it would need to be six, but actually seeing Night Owl 2's origin story was very interesting.
Yeah.
And it was something that, you know, you can debate how necessary it is, but I feel like it actually works as a story to show. And I like the sort of Batman Beyond. I'm not saying they ripped off Batman Beyond, but I'm saying I like the sort of Batman Beyond style thing where he kind of stalks. Well, no, Batman Beyond didn't stalk as the original Batman, but you know what I mean. Like he kind of ends up in the owl cave or whatever, and he's like, you know, I want to be your sidekick.
Yeah, yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah,
yeah, I like that take on it. I don't know if that's from. I never read all of the supplementary stuff in Watchmen. I'm not a very good comic book fan in that way. I didn't read all the actual prose stuff, but I don't know how much of this comes from Alan Moore and how much it actually is original or how much is, you know, J. Michael Straczynski's original work, but I like that take on it. And I think this is an interesting story. I like also that his father was a total asshole and then burns all of his Night Owl toys and all his Night Owl merchandise. And then his mom comes out to see him and he's like, you should probably call the police soon. Your father had a heart attack, but I couldn't remember the number for the police, and then they just sit there by the fire and let him die
right
inside the house because he was abusive and used to beat the mom with a belt. So,
yeah, and then they go to the funeral, and the mom hawks a big loogie on a dad's face.
Yeah. I really, really like the first issue. I don't know how necessary it's going to be as it goes along because so far it's just pretty much Night Owl 2 dealing with this bizarre sort of S&M supervillainess, and then also his relationship with Rorschach. Like, you know, we kind of got some of that stuff from the original Watchmen, so I'll stick with it and see where the story goes, but I wouldn't be surprised either way if it seems like it was worth issues 2 through 4.
Right. Well, let's move right along to another series written by J. Michael Straczynski, Dr. Manhattan, issue number 1. Art in this one's done by Adam Hughes. Issue number 1 has a freaking amazing variant cover by Paul Pope that has an image of Dr. Manhattan assembling what looks like a motor of some kind or something like that, and all the parts are just levitating in the air. And I think Danny would agree that it's probably, if you're going to splurge and get a variant cover for one of these, this would be the one to get.
Yeah.
But variant cover aside, I was really surprised by this. But then once I thought about how much I enjoyed this, I think it made sense because when I thought back to the original Watchmen, the issue that kind of chronicles Dr. Manhattan and how he became the superhuman and getting trapped in the vault and all that was probably the most fascinating. Just it was like the one that, like, I was like, you know, I can't stop reading this. This is such a great issue. Some of the issues got a little heavy-handed in the original. I know that could be considered sacrilege, you know, to say that, but it just felt, it was just a great read. Like, that issue, it was just that, and if I was going to single out one, that would probably be my favorite. And so, going into this, I was kind of skeptical, thinking like, well, what else is there to say that hasn't already been said for Dr. Manhattan? And granted, this does touch a lot on the accident and going back to it, but it's so well written and touches on, like, the timeline of people and him being able to not only see into his future but also go into his past and witness himself doing the things that caused him to become who he is. And there was a kind of a weird cliffhanger for the end of this issue, which I'm not really sure what to make of it, because it kind of goes against what you expect and what you know from seeing the movie or reading the book. But yeah, it's the art in it is very, clean. It works really well for Dr. Manhattan. You know, it's very concise. It's like him as a character. You know, it's like, it's not messy. It's not like the, you know, the comedian or something like that. The art could lend itself to being all over the place. But with this, it's a really great looking book, and I would put this in definitely like my top three of all these. What about you, Danny?
Yeah, I definitely like this one as well. It is a lot like the similar issues as far as story goes. It's very similar to the Dr. Manhattan issues of the original Watchmen.
Right.
So, but it expands on those original ideas, and it's the whole thing is really just one monologue. It's almost like an art film of, you know, before Watchmen. Like, this is sort of the most artsy in terms of both story and the art of the issue. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, you know, J. Michael Straczynski is kind of known for, you know, themes of eternity and not mystical, but sort of spiritual aspects of things. Like, if you've ever read Silver Spectre Requiem or Rising Stars, you know,
Silver Surfer.
What did I say?
Silver Spectre.
Silver Spectre. No comment. Anyway. So Silver Surfer Requiem. He's kind of good at that sort of take on really going to the root of, like, you know, I've completely lost my track of thought.
He's a good writer.
Yes, he's a good writer, and he does this kind of story well, where it's almost not even exactly a plot. It's just kind of like a monologue of the character and sort of going through their emotions and, you know, exploring their emotions through the art, through what they're saying, through what they're seeing. And I definitely enjoyed this issue a lot. I don't know if it's in my top three or so, just because, like I said, it's a bit of a rehash of some of the earlier stuff, but not exactly rehash, because that's sort of a negative way of saying it. But yeah, I don't know. I liked it. The one thing I'm kind of, and I'm not blaming this issue particularly, it's kind of putting them all together, mm-hmm. and now that I'm thinking about it, the one thing I'm getting kind of tired of in all of the Before the Watchmen books is the iconic object from the original Watchmen, and what's its origin? When did the character first see it? And that's why they brought that object into the original Watchmen story. And in this case, the giant clock.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Building that he builds.
That
in
was
space.
My least favorite part.
Yeah, it's originally this, you know, bizarre clock that his father gave him for his birthday when he was a little boy. And apparently that stayed in his subconscious, and he decided to rebuild it on Mars or wherever it was in the original Watchmen.
I thought it was that line that his dad says, where he says, "Your mother thinks it's a bit much for a 9-year-old." And I remember thinking when I was reading that, you mean the audience does? Or everyone in the world does? Yeah, it was a little odd. So this one actually connects to a scene that happens in Before Watchmen Night Owl issue 1, where they have the meeting for the Crime Busters.
Yeah, the first meeting where Captain Metropolis brings them all together.
Yeah, and it's definitely, you can tell that they're working together to make these, you know, the same, this, you know, the scene is set up the same way, it plays out the same way. It actually explains why Dr. Manhattan gets teamed up with Sally, and in Night Owl, they don't really explain it. You know, you see the text and you think, like, that was weird. Why did that happen? I mean, I guess if you were really sat and thought about it, you could probably figure it out. But, and here they explain that Dr. Manhattan manipulates it for it to happen. And there's a really great the single page is split down the middle. And he's saying, like, the timeline now is I'm with Sally Jupiter. I could have been with Night Owl, and this is, you know, but now it's going to be like this. Rorschach. Yeah.
He could have been with Rorschach, and then Night Owl would have been
with
Sally.
Which is cool, because, you know, Night Owl ends up with Sally anyway. It's kind of like inevitable. You know, like these.
Yeah, they're both
happen.
Kind of her two main lovers in the course of the original Watchmen. So it's kind of interesting to see both their feelings. You can see both their sides of their feelings for the first time they met her. If you read the Night Owl story, or if you read the Dr. Manhattan story.
Yeah, so yes. I mean, so, that
yeah, I would definitely, out of, you
read
know,
those together if you can.
Yeah, and this is definitely one that I would say is worth checking out, just because it does have that great writing, and it is very, it's the most artistic out of everything. So, you know, if this, if Watchmen didn't exist beforehand, this would probably be, you know, if all these before Watchmen things were, okay, what am I trying to say? If you took each before Watchmen miniseries and put them in their own separate universe where they're the first thing ever about Watchmen, this would be like the one I would, the universe I would be most interested in living in and reading and caring about if there was no such thing as Watchmen beforehand. Bit contrived, whatever I just said there, but I think some people understood.
Right. I'm sure Ozymandias would understand because he is the smartest man in the universe.
That's right.
And he likes saying that about himself. He likes saying that in Before Watchmen Ozymandias issue number 2, I believe it is. This one is, so it's, in my opinion, somewhere falls a little bit below middle of the road. It's not great, it's not good, but it's not terrible.
I think we differ on this one a little bit, because I think it would definitely be in my top three.
Really? Tell me what you enjoy about Before Watchmen Ozymandias.
Well, I keep going back to it, but my
I know. Wait, I already figured it out. It's the naked Japanese women that are arranging the cocaine in the drug room, right?
You got it.
I knew it.
That's my whole thing. No, it's the fact that my yardstick for all of these series is what is necessary, like what story didn't we get in the first place? And we really knew very little about Ozymandias in Watchmen. And some
he
would
really,
say,
really likes Alexander the Great, and he will not stop talking about it.
No. But I think some people might say we didn't need to know anything about any of this stuff about Ozymandias to, you know, enjoy him as a character. There should have been some mystery. Some people might say that, but I don't think this really spoils any mystery. I don't think his character needs to revel in being uncertain who he is and why he did what he did in the original Watchmen. I think this story really adds a lot to the original Alan Moore story. I also really like Jay Lee's art because I'm a big Dark Tower fan. Mm-hmm. So, and this, you know, this artwork is probably some of the most fitting for the character. Like when you think of how much Ozymandias thinks about himself and how grand he thinks he is, the fact that he's patterned his whole life off of Alexander the Great. And then you think of this very majestic-looking art mm-hmm. with this very cold sort of tone that it has that Jay Lee is known for, which fits so well for Dark Tower because that's what Midworld is like in Dark Tower. It's very majestic yet cold. It fits this character as well. He's very majestic yet cold. So, I mean, there's like a scene when he's a kid and he's on a playground and these other kids beat him up for his lunch every day. It looks like something from Midworld. It's like just all jagged trees. And like,
yeah.
You know, it looks like it's in the middle of some, you know, some post-apocalyptic fantasy world like Dark Tower, but it's really just some playground somewhere near New York City. So
once Ozymandias as a boy starts taking his kung fu lessons, and then he goes back and he's like, he says, "I'm going to warn you once." And then he ends up getting that one boy to like break his leg, and you see the bone tearing through the boy's skin. That was pretty brutal. I did not expect that. I mean, I knew he was going to like try to do something to get back at these kids, but
I think it's fitting for the character though, because he's, you know, he
right.
is so
ruthless
that way in everything. I mean, he killed in Watchmen, in the course of Watchmen, he kills millions of people just to, you know, to fix the world, to make things right. So he's, you know,
yeah, this seemed like to me almost like Batman, because his parents die in the first issue. But if he, instead of using his intelligence and money to do good, he used it to, well, he's still doing good per se, kind of. But his end game is not for the betterment of all mankind. You know what I mean?
Right. I thought the way he put on a mask for the first time was still a little shaky, like when he decided to become a masked crime fighter.
Yeah. He's like, it was my Halloween outfit.
It was my Halloween outfit I was going to wear later that year, which, I mean, that makes sense for his character. Why wouldn't he plan he would plan a year in advance for a party. But just the fact that he decides to become a superhero because his wife, I'm spoiling it, no big spoilers, it's still worth checking out. But he decides to become a superhero because his wife was killed.
Is it wife or is it just girlfriend?
He's just his girlfriend, but I guess it was his...
Miranda, the redheaded girl.
She was his main...
Squeeze,
yeah. And he decides to go out and get revenge on the drug dealers that sort of that gave her an overdose. But I'm like, I don't feel like he would decide to become a masked superhero. He would just go out and he would get his revenge on those guys.
Right.
But, you know, they had to get him in the outfit somehow.
I looked up that bottle of wine that he orders when he goes to the fancy restaurant that she went to. And that's like hundreds of thousands of dollars for that wine. I was like, I wonder what Ozymandias drinks. Maybe I can afford that. Nope, I can't.
Well, it's probably cheaper in the 70s when this is set.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
30 years closer.
It's inflation.
Yeah.
So but, that two-page spread in issue 2 where he busts into that drug ring with the half-naked Japanese girls rearranging the stacks of cocaine, and he's like throwing his, what is it, like a batarang or something.
It's his headband.
Yes. And it shows him like flipping and taking out all these guys and then jumping up onto the rafters, and that was pretty badass.
Yeah. I like the cops, when the police come in after he's broken up this drug ring. I like their reaction to him. He's like, great, another masked weirdo.
Right.
Because
right.
For the most part, when you read the Minutemen and when Night Owl 2 first comes around, everyone's for the most part seems kind of happy. Like, oh boy, another masked crime fighter. But the fact that finally in Before Watchmen, someone's like, another one of these fucking weirdos.
Yeah. I got to say, though, that final panel of issue 2 of Ozymandias, where the comedian shows up. That was kind of rough from an artistic standpoint. Do you not agree?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of hard to explain. He looks kind of like, what's the word? I mean, not jaggedy. He looks kind of
the proportions are like all off or something. It just looks so odd
looking
at it. So I'm assuming issue 3 will have even more of the comedians. Maybe he'll look a little bit more like we're used to seeing him in that. It'll be interesting to see if he changes the way it looks from this last panel here.
I'd definitely like to see Jay Lee draw more Watchmen characters and see all of his takes other than just comedian and Ozzy. So we'll see. Hopefully that shows up in future issues.
All right, and I think we only have one more series that we haven't talked about, and it's the one that kind of talks about all of them all together, and that's Darwin Cook's Minutemen. We both pretty much liked this one with issue 1 back in July. Danny, what do you think now that 3 issues are out? Are you still enjoying this?
I think I'm enjoying this more with issue 2 and 3 than I did with 1, because I liked issue 1, but I remember thinking that I wasn't sure where it was going to go.
Right.
And I remember us kind of basically saying, like, it was the first issue just kind of like is like, you know, 18, however many pages of them just setting up the bowling pins. So it wasn't the most interesting issue, but it really focuses a lot on the original Night Owl, Hollis Mason.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that his stories, that his, you know, take on everything, because it's told from the point of view of his book that he wrote in Watchmen. And I like, you know, kind of learning more about the Minutemen and the fact that, you know, things were kind of corrupt from the beginning, because I don't want to spoil it too much, but their first big bust as a group doesn't go the way they plan, and they cover it up and they trick the American people into thinking these great heroes have shown up and saved you from a horrible terrorist threat, even though it wasn't exactly that way. And I like the fact that there's, you know, that sort of shadow over these characters right from the beginning, because that fits, you know, with this style of the universe a lot better.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And then the relationship between Hollis Mason and the Silhouette, the member of the group who's the lesbian girl who's trying to take down these child
traffickers,
murderers and rapists and things like that.
Yeah, that was an interesting take. I like, because she was a very interesting character for all of the 20 seconds that you really saw her in the movie or in the original graphic novel.
Right.
Because you learn very little about the Minutemen overall in the original Watchmen. So that's why I think this miniseries is the most necessary, And this was actually something Alan Moore had discussed doing in the first place, was doing this. If he had done a prequel himself, it would have been a Minutemen prequel.
Well, and this is almost, I mean, if you've ever read Darwin Cook's New Frontier, where he, you know, does like goes back and tells his own version of the origin of those characters, this seems like, you know, Watchmen, the New Frontier, almost.
Yeah.
You know, where it's still in his style, like where I mentioned in issue one, he's not trying to write like Alan Moore, you know, it still feels like Darwin Cook, but it still feels necessary, you know, we're talking about stuff that wasn't apparent in the original text, so, yeah, definitely. Right. Would you say this one number one for you, or somewhere in the top three?
Yeah, this one's in my top three as well, for sure. Well, I mean, do you want to go through what our top tens are?
We'll recap here for the end of the show. For me, I would say my favorite overall, as of right now, because it may change, would be Minutemen. Number two, Dr. Manhattan, that we just talked about, with the beautiful art. Number three, Ozymandias, even though, you know, the J. Lee art, you know, can be kind of odd at times. Number four is Silk Spectre. Unless the next issue is the last, so it could, you know, blow me away with what happens there. Number five, Night Owl. Like I said, kind of falls in the middle. And then six and seven, Rorschach and the Comedian, because I don't know what the hell happened to Brian Azzarello. I mean, I've never been a huge fan of his. And I liked the Joker that you mentioned earlier, the book he did, but I tried to get into 100 Bullets, and I couldn't get into it, and I don't know. I don't know if he was the guy for the job. I think that might have been a wrong decision for editorial to choose him.
I think he needs his own room, you know, to create his characters, and I don't know what else Brian Azzarello has done that needed to fit as tightly into a box as a Watchmen prequel. Like, you know, you have to have the characters fit your understanding of them from the original work. So, you know, when he did his Joker, he took away all the walls. He created his own Joker that was completely apart from any Joker you'd really seen before. And, you know, and in his own original work is pretty much the same way. So the
I'm looking on my bookshelf here, because he also did a book at DC called Lex Luthor book with Lee Bermejo.
Oh, right.
And that was pretty good. Yeah. It's not too, it's like three issues or something like that. But that was good. So I don't know what happened here. But what about you, Danny? What's your top seven?
I'm kind of torn. I think tied for first would be Silk Spectre and Ozymandias.
Okay.
For pretty much the same reasons, you know, that you like them as well. Minutemen is number three for me. I think it just comes in a little lower for some reason. Let me think about it for a second. Then Night Owl is number four. Dr. Manhattan's number five. And then Rorschach and Comedian are pretty much, you know, again, the lowest on the scale, because they're the ones I enjoyed the least. Like, I really enjoyed the other five.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of issue to issue as far as the other five go, but they're all things I'd stick with. Rorschach and Comedian I wouldn't stick with if they weren't part of this overall thing that's going on.
So, wrapping up here, we didn't even mention the Curse of the Crimson Corsair. Basically completely given up on it, because
yeah, so have I.
I've been, you know, holding on to these issues, and then I kind of read them all together before recording this show, and I didn't read them like in the order they were released. So unless you're going to the comic shop every Wednesday and reading these in the order they are released, it's going to be a pain in the ass. I mean, granted, there are only like two or three pages in the back, but it's just like, I'm already trying to keep the continuity between the books and how much they're crossing over, and you know, not to mention every other comic that comes out.
My issue with the whole thing still stands from the last podcast we did. Who cares? Because it's not going, because the original pirate story from Watchmen was like this double, triple meaning,
right,
where it tied into the story that was going on with the superhero characters. It was its own thing that was told, you know, chronologically along with the original issues. There was actually a point to it. There's no point other than just cashing in on another pirate story. Like there's not going to be some sort of, I could never imagine that if you took the overall story of the Crimson Corsair, you could find some interconnecting theme between that story and all seven miniseries.
Right.
Like, I remember you asking me, like, would I feel better about it if you saw someone reading the Crimson Corsair in an issue of Before Watchmen? And I was like, that's not the issue. The issue is the fact that the theme of the original Black Freight story tied in to the theme of Watchmen. The theme of this is not going to tie in with all seven stories. That's going to be some masterwork of writing or editing if they somehow are able to pull that off. And they're not. So, yeah, I'm not even bothering with
what it.
I'm
not even... It gets to the end of the pirate story and, you know, the guy dies, and then all of a sudden he close up on his eyes and he wakes up and it was actually all a dream, and he's like, wow, that was a giant waste of time. And then it's a commentary on the entire Before Watchmen project. Would you like it then?
You know what? You got me. Yes. That would be amazing.
You'd slow clap.
Yes. I'd put the issue down on the table and I'd slow clap.
All right. Well, there you go, folks. So that about does it for our second installment of our Before Watchmen podcast. Hope you enjoyed that. If you want to send us an email, let us know what you thought. Do that at contactfourthwall@yahoo.com. We're on the Facebook. We're on the Twitter @4WP. Send us your thoughts. Send us you know, what you think about this whole tangled mess that we have got ourselves into. That about does it. I'm Freddie.
And I'm Danny.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The end is nigh. Get it? The thing they say.
Yeah.
Ugh.